Oh, hello, everybody. My interest in this subject goes back a long way. In fact, when my daughter came back from school, this is a long time ago, she came back one day and said, "Electricity is boring." And I was completely horrified. How could anybody think that electricity was boring? But then I thought about it, and actually the way it's taught in schools isn't very interesting. They do their best to make it quite boring. So I started asking people I knew what they remembered about school electricity. And of course, everybody remembers the simple circuit with the battery, the switch, and the bulb, light bulb. But the other thing people remembered was the Van de Graaff generator. Not all schools have them, but amazingly, they're still considered relatively not hazardous, and so schools are still allowed to have them today. And they are extraordinarily wonderful things, if I'm sure a lot of you have played with them. And what schools used to get wrong, they would show the kids these, an unforgettable experience, and then they would talk to them about positive and negative charges. Well, if you've witnessed something as elemental as this, where your hair's standing on end, you're getting occasional shocks, and all other sorts of weird things, the air smells funny, the last thing you're interested in rise to your mind would be, oh, I need to know about these positive and negative charges. And so I sort of felt, I don't know, it intrigued me, what should you tell kids about it? And I'm not sure, I don't think I've got it right, because I think some of the things would, some of you may think some of all this stuff about electric shocks is tasteless and shouldn't be taught to children, but children like horror stories and things, so I don't know. So, starting from the beginning, ancient man didn't know anything about electricity, but they still got electric shocks because of lightning. And of course, not knowing anything about electricity, they thought of it as divine intervention. The gods were angry. And not surprising, I mean, being out in a thunderstorm, it does feel as if somebody up there is cross. And this sort of elemental thing, it's inspired artists through the ages, particularly in the 19th century, there's a sort of fashion for pictures of the apocalypse, which inevitably included lightning in some shape or form. It's a sort of life-changing event if you're struck by lightning, fairly obvious. about two-thirds of the people who are struck survive, surprisingly. And actually, I know somebody who was struck by lightning. In fact, his whole family was struck by lightning. He was a child at the time, and this is where he was struck. This is Australia's highest mountain. It's just sort of north of Melbourne on the Blue Mountains. Matthew Kneebone. And they had a family tradition of trying to climb to the top of the mountain every Christmas. And one year, a thunderstorm broke out, and he turned round to look at his sister, and there's a blinding flash of light, and that's all he remembers. He just woke up 20 minutes later, being carried down the mountain in the arms of a stranger. It was actually his sister who got it worse, because the bad thing about this mountain is that it's popular for people walking up it. So the park rangers had made this path, which you can see, but they made it out of metal. So the lightning went all along the path, so the whole family got struck. And it was actually his sister who bore the brunt of the strike. But even she, all her clothes were burnt, and she was in hospital for a while, but even she survived, though she has been profoundly deaf ever since. Matthew himself, he's an artist, talented artist, knew nothing about electricity, but became fascinated by it and started drawing electrical objects, not really understanding what went on inside. But his fascination has continued, and slowly learning about electricity. And he now makes, as he describes, sort of bizarre circuits that occasionally work. So yes, a life-changing event for the whole family, obviously. So what's surprising, most people aren't killed, and they've got these very strange burns. that are very distinctive and not like anything else. It's also surprising, I think, because it's the current going through your heart that's going to kill you. Or well, actually, it's not necessarily with lightning, because the burns can be worse. But if you get struck by lightning, it's likely to go from your head to your toe, and that's the most lethal route. So that's 250 milliamps is supposed to be the maximum dose, which of course lightning's a lot more than that. 500 milliamp from one hand to the other, and you could have 10 amps going up one leg and going down the other, apparently. But in a way, we're lucky we're humans. Poor cows have a much worse time. Because when lightning strikes, the earth around the place where it hits the ground goes up to hundreds of thousands of volts, and then the voltage gradually decays to earth as it radiates out. But because the cow's front legs are different from away from the back legs, there can be a huge potential between them, and that can be enough to be fatal, particularly because cows have these dainty little legs that sink into the ground, and if the ground's damp, you've got a low resistance as well. So, yeah, cows have a bad time of it. Well, so far, I've just been talking about elemental, just lightning. Man-made electricity can be equally dangerous, but it's very, very recent in historical times. It really only goes back to the 18th century. The ancient Greeks got as far as discovering that if you rubbed amber with cloth, the cloth would stick to it, or it would attract little particles. And the Greek word for amber is electron, and that's where the word electricity comes from. But they didn't really get any further. So, yes, as I say, man-made electricity really starts in the early 18th century, with this scientist, Robert Boyle. You possibly remember there's something called Boyle's Law that relates the pressure of a gas to its volume. So here he is demonstrating his air pump, not an electrical thing. And in the central, there's a central wooden column, and on top, you can hardly see it, is a bell jar. And inside the bell jar is a poor little bird. And his assistant, immediately to his left, Hawksby, is pumping out the air, and as it becomes a vacuum, the poor bird keels over. I'm never quite sure if the bird can then be resuscitated, or if that's it for the bird. Anyway, there are other things, tricks you could do with this air pump and the bell jar. You could put a candle in it and the flame would go out, or you could put something that makes a noise in it and you couldn't hear it because sound doesn't travel through a vacuum. And his assistant, Hawksby, to sort of raise funds for their research as much as anything, got into manufacturing these air pumps for other people. And the people who bought them, they weren't, well, none of them in a way were what we would consider scientists. It was at that time, they were sort of natural philosophers, they would call themselves. But actually most of the people who bought these air pumps were showmen. And they would take them around the country, copying these sort of spectacular results and demonstrating the tricks you could do with an air pump. And it was these showmen trying to clean the mess off their bell jars from the poor birds and all the other things and the candles, discovered when rubbing the bell jars that they had the same effects as the ancient Greeks had with their amber. And they were always looking for new tricks to add to their shows. And so it was these showmen who went on to develop what became the first static electric generators. So really that's just a bell jar on its side with cloth rubbing against it, and a sort of gearbox so you can turn it really quite fast. And this generated considerably more static electricity than had previously been possible, and so enabled a sort of range of tricks, the sort of tricks that people still do with Van de Graaff generators and stuff. But at the high point of their shows always was the electric boy. So they would electrify a child. So the in here you can see the shoe of the or the foot of the child is connected to the electric generator, and then if the child put out his finger and came close to anything, a little spark would go across. It was quite painful for the child, because the child is supported by silk threads from the ceiling, so he's completely insulated from earth. I don't know. It was obviously quite widespread, because there are lots of contemporary illustrations of this. One from the chart, poor guy's nose. A variation of this is the electric kiss, where the woman is standing on a stool which has supported on glass pillars, so she's completely insulated from earth. And when they kiss, there's this extra electric frisson and sparks. But I mean, it's quite tender, your lips. It'd be quite painful, more painful than the finger, I think. So, I mean, this was extraordinary to them. They've never seen anything other sort of natural phenomena, anything like it. It was a sensation of the age. And I quite often wish people still had that awe and the magic of electricity. It's sad that we've sort of lost it. But their reaction at the time was, predictably one of their reactions, was to think that it would cure absolutely anything. So it became a sort of treatment for all sorts of quacks, and quite respectable doctors believed that it might cure things. It was always a bit painful. I don't think the little girl on the left-hand side is looking forward to her treatment, whatever it's for. And a lot of people realized that it was quackery. So this is a cartoon from the time, I think by Gilray. So the electrician, as they called themselves, is on the left, again on a board with on glasses, on glass tumblers to insulate him. And he's got this sort of chain reaction that he's touching the people who are all holding hands. So they all get a shock until the man at the end is miraculously cured. But I think it's fairly obvious in the cartoon that Gilray thought it was a load of mumbo-jumbo. The two prime demonstrators, this is from the 1750s to the 70, till the end of the 18th century really, were these two characters, James Graham on the left and Gustavo Catafalco on the right. Catafalco had come from Poland and came to England with his family and his black cat called Evil. And he was described as part scientist, part conjurer, and part quack. And so that was him. But he made a successful living touring around the country with his cat. His cat was always part of the show. That's why I included this image. James Graham had a slightly better reputation, really. He particularly believed that electricity was good for promoting fertility. And he opened the Temple of Hymen in Pall Mall. And the high point, the most spectacular part of this temple, was the first floor. They installed this enormous installation called the Celestial Bed. And couples could pay £50 to spend the night in this bed. There were no contemporary illustrations of this, Graham left some very detailed, close details of description of it in a lecture he did a few years later. And I was amazed. I managed to find these lecture details in the British Library. And as a cartoonist, I thought it was my duty then to draw it from how he described it. So the bed is on glass pillars, so it all can be charged up. And if you look underneath the bed, there are men with an electrostatic generator. There are also men playing a violin for sort of romantic or whatever music. There's somebody putting strange sort of things like incense on a fire to make strange smells. There are all sorts of tricks. But I said, it's possible that they could have seen the eerie corona glow all around the bed. And the sort of just having paid so much money for the night, you know, perhaps they felt duty-bound that it was bound to work. He added every trick he could think in the book. There was even a handle for the gentleman. It's easy to laugh at it, but I can imagine that sort of the exoticness of the surroundings might have promoted some sort of passion that had been lacking if their problems had been emotional. It didn't last that long. I think it was just too expensive, that particular one. So, yeah, electricity was, at that time, you could only generate a tiny amount of electricity. These original static electricity generators, it were painful, but certainly not fatal. This began to change in the mid-18th century with the invention of the Leyden jar. So this is Van Musschenbroek. He's one of the people who invented it. It was invented independently in different places. The other one was Edward George von Keist, a religious man, a deacon from a cathedral on the borders of Poland and Germany. Anyway, the idea was that they were trying to think of ways of storing the electricity and thought, well, you sort of store things in jars and, you know, maybe store chemicals in jars. So they sort of attached a jar to the static electricity generator. And without any idea of what any theory behind it, but amazingly, Musschenbroek got an enormous shock and was terrified and wrote to fellow experimenters telling them on no account to try and repeat this dangerous experiment. And of course, everybody did. And they soon realized they didn't need the water in the jar. It was just the electric charge between the inside of the jar and the outside of the jar. And of course, this is the origin of the capacitor. These are just capacitors. And if you've probably seen Wimhurst machines and that, which you attach to Leyden jars, and that gives you the enormous sparks that arc across. Well, with much more powerful sparks and things, people then started to wonder if it was related to lightning. I think with the little sparks, it just felt like something completely different. And it was Benjamin Franklin, the American experimenter, who did the famous experiment with the kite, sending a wire, conductive wire, up a kite in a thunderstorm, and then managing to draw a spark from a key attached to the wire. And drawing the parallel in this painting, to the left, you can see a couple of cherubs playing with the sort of man-made electricity there as well. Franklin was actually quite careful. I only found out the details of what he did just the other day. He's got his son William there, and it was his son William who's flying the kite on a silk thread, so he's perfectly safe. But he also had a thin hemp cord that he'd soaked in salt water and dried out. So with the thunderstorm, that got wet and started becoming conductive, and it was this wet hemp cord that wouldn't have transferred quite so much electricity, probably, as the key. But it was a dangerous thing to do, and what's his name? George Wilhelm Rickman was killed trying to copy the experiment the next year, slightly later. But Benjamin Franklin went on to invent, related to this, the lightning conductor. And this was immediately very popular and successful, and it came into general use by the end of the 18th century to safely channel the lightning down from the highest point of a building to earth. Of course, There are other safe things that were discovered not long after the Faraday cage, that if you surround yourself by an insulating cage, the electricity all just goes around the outside. And there are some science centres, this one's in the Deutsche Museum in Munich, where you can actually go inside a Faraday cage and experience the sensation. So, at the moment, we've got more powerful sparks from man-made electricity, but not the sort of electricity that we take for granted now, current electricity, low voltage, comparatively low voltage electricity. And this starts from the end of the century with Alessandro Galvani. He was actually an anatomist who was experimenting on frogs. And history has it that he just happened to have a static electric generator close to some of his frog legs that started twitching. I don't know if this is true, it's disputed. But it got him, he's a methodical experimenter, it got him trying things out. And he discovered that he could, frog's legs would be twitched by electrical effects. So he attached two of the severed tendons, in this slide, one to earth and one to a kite with a wire. But then he found that when he had frog's legs hanging out in his garden on a line, as you do, that they were twitching. And because he was such a good, such a detailed researcher, he pinned that down in the end to the iron wire touching the brass hooks, and it was these two dissimilar metals that were causing the legs to twitch. So in his later experiments, he had these two bars made of different metals, and he attached, when they touched each other, the legs would twitch. And he published these results, or I think, you know, he just sent a letter to somebody he admired, who was Alessandro Volta, also in Italy. Volta seized on it. He was a much more flamboyant, outgoing character. And after a few years, came up with his famous pile, Volta's pile. And this is the first modern battery. A load of plates of alternating silver and iron, I think, with pads of salty water in between them. And with this, you got the first sort of low current current electricity. Initially, this was just used to extend those experiments on frogs and chickens and scale them up, so you could try them out on humans as well, dead humans. There was a famous experiment on a murderer called George Forster, who'd just been hung by Galvani's nephew, Giovanni Aldini. The dead jaws, by according to where you put the terminals of the Volta's pile, you get these different effects. The dead jaws quivered and one eye leered open. Then his clenched fist rose into the air. Finally, his legs started to kick violently and his back arched into the air. Spooky stuff. Well, literally spooky, because, I mean, this is where Mary Shelley got the idea for Frankenstein and wrote it a few years later. An endearing myth. People were getting, copying this experiment quite a lot. It was so spectacular and so creepy. And it culminated in one that caused a scandal in Glasgow in 1818. This is a scientist called Andrew Ure. And he managed to get another recently hung murderer to do even more spooky things, including breathing heavily. And people really thought that he was about to come back to life. But the main effect this had was creating a sort of national scandal. And this line of research became sort of taboo, as people just thought it was horrifying and people shouldn't do it. which actually delayed the development of a lot of medical things, which I'll talk about in a bit, by 50 years or so. So at that time, it was still quite a sort of specialist interest. People might go to shows and see the wonders of electricity, but it wasn't part of their lives. The first time, really, when people saw electricity as part of their lives, I think it's probably in public lighting, particularly in America, because in Europe, gas lighting was more established. And these early electric lights, they were arc lights, and so you've got these very powerful lights, so you don't want very many of them, but they put them on tall towers. Particularly Detroit was famous for this. The whole entire city was lit by 17 of these towers with arc lights on the top. Must have felt a bit like prison or something, I think, but they did gradually make them smaller. But of course, the other thing about arc lights is that they need a high voltage. I think it was 3,000 volts. So they made them smaller, but they still needed the same high voltage. So by the 1880s, when the telephone had come into use, the streets in New York were just full of wires, overhead wires, telephone wires, and the street lighting wires. And up to that moment, I don't think people were particularly frightened of electricity, but then a variety of things happened all around the same time, and it all rather changed. So if you look carefully at this image, there's a man stuck up the telegraph pole. He was a telegraph linesman called John Feeks, repairing the telephone line, unaware that one of the high voltage cables had dropped on a telephone line further down the road. And he was electrocuted. He died, but he was stuck up there, thrashing around in all these wires for several hours, drawing a vast crowd down below, creating a huge national to-do. And people threw their telephones out of the window, and they wouldn't walk on manhole covers for fear of the rivers of death flowing underneath. And even cartoonists suggested that people needed to walk around in rubber suits. But it did have a long-term effect on New York. This is a view of the same street, the first one from about 1890, the time of the Great Electric Wire Panic, and the same view 20 years later, all the wires hidden underground. Well, coming at the same time as this, governments, both in Europe and America, had got rather scared of the riots caused by public executions. They felt the crowds were out of control and a sort of threat to public order. And what was needed was some modern scientific way of execution. And that's what gave birth to the electric chair. So another reason to be scared of electricity. And what made this worse was that you may know that Edison's electric system, original electric system, was DC, 110 volts DC. And he was in a war with Westinghouse, whose system was AC. And so the problem with DC is at that voltage, you had to have very thick copper cables, and the maximum distance from the powerhouse was probably about 10 miles, and very expensive even then, the copper. Westinghouse, with his AC, could use transformers and go up to thousands of volts and had a range of hundreds of miles. So Edison was under threat and got into cahoots with this rather unpleasant character called Harold Brown. And he's basically a salesman, but a fancy dude, called himself grandly an electrician. So this circuit may look like something special, but if you look more closely, in the bottom right-hand corner is a dog. And he rounded up stray dogs and electrocuted them with AC to show how dangerous it was. And then went on to bigger animals. And I think he even electrocuted an elephant. So no wonder people were terrified of electricity. Fortunately, Harold Brown was eventually discredited and AC survived. So, and of course, electrocution went out of fashion as a form of execution, as there were various botched things that didn't really work. So that vein of electric shocks has disappeared, But they returned in the last sort of 10 or 15 years with the taser. And this is the idea that you could have a non-lethal shock. And this promotional slide, so you can hit somebody anywhere on their body with a taser and it'll knock them out. It's painful, but the people who promoting it claim that it's not so dangerous. And I suppose, you probably can't see it in this slide, but it's clearer in this one. What actually happens is that it shoots out two reels of very, very fine electrical wire. And so the shock that the victim gets only goes between one wire and the other wire, so it's not going so likely to go near your heart. And I don't know whether it's worse or better, but truncheons weren't a very good idea. You know, you could get concussions, so I'm not sure. Anyway, that's a one form that electric shocks continue in the modern world. But of course, there are lots of beneficial things that electric shocks are used for. These start perhaps at the end of the 19th century. This is a doctor called Augustus Waller, and this is his dog, Jimmy. And because they were much more sensitive instruments, this is something called a Lippmann capillary electrometer. His dog just had a front leg and a back leg in salty water. The electrometer would twitch in rhythm with the dog's heart. And this is the origin of the ECG and measuring the heart rate. And eventually led to the defibrillator, though I'm sure that introduction of the defibrillator was delayed until the 1930s because of this taboo against experimenting on bodies. In fact, the first human wasn't subjected to one until 1947. This is my defibrillator, given to me by my GP when he moved surgery. The capacitor is about that by that. It's 44 microfarads at 4,500 volts. So I thought they might be bigger than that, actually, but they say that it's better to give the heart a big shock because then it stops completely and then it's more likely to start up as it's supposed to rather than a small shock and you may start up irregularly. Well, I've only got not much longer. So I'll go briefly through some of the other less reputable forms of electricity. This is my own territory, a coin-operated version, where you just pay, you dial as much electricity as you want, insert the coin, and hold on to the handles, and it's a sort of cure-all. Or this one, which is a game, and the prize is an electric shock. More long-lasting are the violet ray apparatus. This is one of mine, which doesn't work anymore, but I like the idea of being able to choose the right amount of current. The instrument, you sort of rub it against your head. This is a later version that I have that I can demonstrate outside later on. And of course, it continues to this day with sort of TENS apparatus to tone you up. But generally, electricity in the home has just got safer and safer and safer. They don't publish these statistics anymore, but these are summaries of the reasons why people ended up in A&E. And if you just look at the left-hand column of figures, the different electrical things this in a year, the highest number is 171 cases from an appliance lead. Well, that might have been just tripping over it, but you'd see how much safer electricity is than a door. The number of accidents involving doors, and I don't know, I couldn't find, I've got another one of skirting boards are even more dangerous than doors, so of course, electricity in the home is partly so much safer because of these fabulous devices, the RCD, residual current detector, I don't know, yeah, maybe. So the supply is on the left and the appliance would be on the right. And it's a toroid transformer. And it's, I think sometimes I've seen only one or two turns of the live wire going round and one or two of the neutral wires come back. Wound in the opposite directions, no current goes round the toroid. But if there's a slight imbalance, if a tiniest amount of current is going to earth instead of back to neutral, that's enough to induce this tiny current in the toroid, and which is black here, the leakage current sense, and that trips the circuit out. I'm sure I've been saved by them many times. I'm always touching the wrong thing. So electricity in the home is got pretty safe. But of course, there's still awesome amounts of electricity in the sky. I love pylons. There's something very romantic about them all. I was in the arcade last year, and some engineers from National Grid came in, and we got chatting, and we ended up swapping pictures of our favourite pylons on our phones. From that, they gave me an invitation of a tour around a really big substation outside Ipswich for the supergrid. And I had a great time there. I'm just going to skip that slide, I'm running out of time. So this is 460 kilovolts. AC is the voltage of the supergrid. This is about as close as you're allowed to get to 460 kilovolts. I think I was about 5 meters away. These are the wires coming out of a transformer. But amazingly, modern insulation is so good that I was allowed to hold on to this wire that's got 460 kilovolts inside. It's about that diameter. One thing that made me sad about this visit was that I love substations too, all the dramatic shapes of the insulators, and then there's the humming and all that sort of supernatural stuff. It's sort of like where the aliens would land, but it's also that you can stand and watch it and puzzle out what all the different things do. And it's outside because the insulator obviously is air, and that's why it has to be outside. But what I didn't know was that all this is changing. What they were proud of at this great big substation was this stuff, which is indoors. And this does the same thing. Inside these cast aluminium tubes is this gas called sulfur hexafluoride. And all the breakers and all the switchgear all takes place inside a shed, inside these hidden tubes. So from the outside, it could just be another factory. It's lost its sort of alien appeal. So to end, I just want to say that I think it's even more vital that children are exposed to the Van de Graaff generator and allowed to play with it. Otherwise, we'll just lose the idea that electricity is magical altogether. Thank you very much.